Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Split Shift podcast. This is brought to you by me, Knife of Brian, or just Brian as I prefer. And I'm hoping to bring to you a series of chats recorded on Instagram Live. Each week, it could be weekly, it could be fortnightly, depending how long this lockdown goes on for. But as often as I can, I'll be delivering a little chat for you to listen to at your own leisure, usually recorded live, unedited, because I can't do that. I don't know how to edit. So this is a chat I had earlier this week with Kareem Roberts, Broke Dinner, local chef, and probably one of the most influential chefs on Instagram. So have a listen, and yeah, sorry it's not edited. I know the sound quality is not that brilliant on this one, but you know, if more people listen to this, then I will endeavor to try and improve the quality of the audio. But yes, here you go. This is me chatting with Broke Dinner.
Yo, Happy New Year, Brian. Fun fact, happy first time I'm actually speaking to Brian, yo. Fun fact.
I know, man. It's just too long. It's too long, isn't
it? We've been social media friends for what? 6 years, 5 years, maybe four? Since Facebook times?
It's been a while. And I was thinking, I was following you on Instagram, right? When you just had a couple of thousand followers, you know? And I was looking at those numbers, man. And it's like...
I'll be putting in that work, bro.
I know, mate.
Hey, what I want to say is shout out to everyone who has been consistently grinding on social media. Not just on social media, but in anything, man. Anybody who's been grafting away at anything. I don't care if you mix paint, make music, or if you count coins. I don't care what you do. As long as you've been doing it consistently and progressively for a long time, yo, I tip my hat to you, man. That's hard work.
Yeah, no, it's hard. It's hard, especially now. Especially now. Now we're in these times, man. It's just like...
I don't know what you think. Do you think it's easier to create content in a pandemic or hard?
It's definitely harder. Yeah. Really? For me, it's like my writing, for instance. You know, trying to come up with something that is relevant and on point, apart from me saying, bored.
No, let me speak to you as the writer, because I don't get to speak to many other chefs that have a penchant for the pen and are, you know, prolific with penmanship. We don't really come together enough. There ain't enough of us out there like that. But I think maybe what you should do you read a lot about food? It starts there.
Yeah, I sort of flip now. I mean, I've just literally just started Tom Kerridge's book.
That book is so dope. That book is so good. That book is gorgeous.
I'm just literally starting the first chapter about half an hour ago. I just picked it up and thought, oh, well, you know, I better read this, you know, and it's blowing my mind already. But I don't read enough food books. I tend to my reading tends to be my other world. That's like, I'll read something else.
I don't read as much as I would like, and I'm ashamed to say that. I do consume spoken word. Podcasts or audiobooks. I consume audiobooks where possible. And while that's not conventional reading, it is still efficient reading.
Yeah. No, it's all information going in.
It's about retention. Yeah. And I think that's where we lose it. Oh my gosh. That's a problem about reading. Reading can be a challenge because I think a lot of us have this perception of ourselves that we are bad readers. How many of us read something and then can't recall the last few lines that we wrote? Like that's discouraging, man.
Yeah.
It instantly evaporates. It disappears into the ether. That does not encourage you to continue reading at all. If anything, it does the opposite. It's like, yo, this is fucking pointless. I may as well do something else.
Yeah, 100%.
And as writers, we don't make reading enjoyable enough for the consumer, do we? I think reading should be more of an interactive thing. Like, as writers, we should think about the audience when we write. Like, how are they breaking this down? Because I've reread some of the sentences that I compose, and oh my gosh, grammatically they're okay, but shit, are they independent ideas on top of one another where we don't break it? We don't make. Oh man, have you ever read something that's just so difficult to understand?
I could show you something. I'm reading. I'm at the moment. Okay, so I'm looking to go to university next year. Well, this year. Yeah. I'm just going back because I thought I can't do this forever, man. I can't graft in the kitchen for every day. So I thought, right, I'm going to go do nutrition and human health. That's what I'm looking at doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting to get my biology brain on now, like reading biology books, and oh my days, man. The words, I am struggling hard. I'm just trying to get a head start because I think I don't want to be in a classroom going, please.
No, you know something? That's where we were wrong as students. We felt embarrassed to ask questions.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Like, you feel like, oh, I can't ask a question. No one else is asking questions. Why I have to be the dumb one? Yo, the smart ones are the ones with the questions, yo. The inquisitive ones, the ones who want to understand more, the ones who don't understand. But to ask a question is a sign of effort. It's a sign of attempt. It's a sign of, yo, I
100%.
And the person who doesn't ask loses out so much more. I wish I had asked more questions in school. I wish. But I didn't feel as if it was cool enough to do. And I think we don't make learning a cool experience. I find that such a problem.
Yeah. Oh, I'll tell you what. Well, it needs to be cool now because I'm paying money for this now. So now I know it's coming out of my pocket. I'm going to be asking every question.
Man, you're really going back to school in this new era of non-traditional learning, man.
Yeah.
Like, yo, you can do it. Yo, didactic education has changed in favor of efficient, more audio didacticy. Like, we teach ourselves. And I think you may need some form of a qualification to put yourself in the best position to achieve opportunities. Like, they may need, okay, minimum barrier for entry. You need this degree or criteria, this certificate. I disagree nowadays, I consume so much knowledge online, and I don't know who these people are, let alone what makes them qualified to speak on subjects that I find valuable. But I don't care. Ultimately, as a consumer, we don't care. It's going to be a little bit. I think the thing about university is it's a sign of discipline. It takes a hard climb. It shows a lot. It's oh my gosh, the endurance that it takes. You ready for this, Chef?
Maybe. I've got until September, so I'm just trying to, I'm making myself ready a little bit at a time, and then, you know, come September, I hope to be in a better position. I mean, I'm still going to be working full time, which I'm still not sure how that's going to work because it's going to be difficult, man.
But this, like, and you bring, and this is where the pandemic has given us as chefs a lot of time to not only reevaluate our lives, but to reassess our goals, our financial goals. I believe every chef that prior to 2020, 90% of us didn't have 5-year goals. Is that a safe estimate?
Yeah.
I think, or maybe higher. 95% of us did not have 5-year goals. Do you agree or disagree?
Yeah, well, I've always had 5-year goals. My 5-year goals are moving. You know, I've probably got 10 different 5-year goals. But yes.
Do you think most chefs have 5-year goals?
Nah, they don't. They don't. A lot of chefs look for the next 2 years done.
What do we look at? Where do we set our what are our achievable goals as chefs? This isn't more interesting question. What, to become a head chef?
Yeah.
How many of us don't even get there?
There's so many, and that's one of the things I sort of talk about when I talk to the colleges and I talk to the students. I say to them, you can't go into this thinking, oh, I'm going to be head chef. I'm going to go in and be on the pass. Your goal should be set yourself a 5-year goal should be, I'm going to learn as much as I can. I'm going to then see where I am. Mm-hmm. Some of them in 5 years' time will make it, will be thinking about being head chef. You know, when I see 23-year-old head chefs, my everything clenches up. I'm thinking, what have you learned in that time? Or you've got to be good. You've got to be good. So I hope you are.
They can be good. Instead of looking at the age, you have to look at the experience. Because at 23 years old, how long have you been a chef for? 6 years, yo. You can be head chef in 6 years.
Yeah, you can be. They have to bust their asses.
You have to be. But I think the very, very accelerated path to being a competent head chef, I think 5 to 6 years. Very few and far between. And even then, the chances of you failing in that first role is astronomical.
Yeah.
But once again, okay, you get to the head chef goal, then what? Because we all know that's a young man's race, and it's, what do you get out of being a head chef? It's really, you're so replaceable, and they're just waiting to find a young girl. Yeah. Like, we have no retirement plan as chefs. I find that totally discouraging. We have nothing to fall back on. And retirement age comes so much earlier for a chef than other professions. It's not 55 or 60. Chef, man, yo, you're lucky if you're still functional at 50, man.
Why I'm looking for my way out.
Leaving is the answer. We have to.
No, well, this is. I mean, that's for me. That's where the angle that I'm going at it from. You know, I'm just learning about food, but from a different angle. I want to go. I use the nutrition part as part of my business, part of my brand, part of my. So if it involves writing recipes for, you know, for people who are on diets or doing recipe plans for sports teams, that's the angle I want to go down.
I spoke to my girlfriend about it yesterday, and I was saying, like, you know, something in moving forward when I design recipes and everything, why am I not including calories and macros and nutrition in it? Because that means absolutely nothing to most of my current supporters and audience and chefs. You don't care how many fucking calories in the fucking rosti. You don't care about whether or not this fucking Anna fits in your fucking macros. But, however, there's an audience out there that is craving that data. Yeah, and the thing about it is that they can actually, that information is so valuable to them. That is the equivalent. Like, macro to someone on a diet is the equivalent to a costed dish and a food cost for a chef. It makes that much. It's that important. It's that valuable.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where we are. That is where we are. Because
we cookbook and none of them have the energy content and composition on there.
Nah. So, but it's not fun. It's not sexy.
I've tried that before and it's so fucking difficult to tell how much fucking sodium is in a fucking serving of fucking biryani. It's
difficult. Yeah, well, exactly. But that's where I'll come in, you know? So you'll be able to send me your recipe and I'll convert it, send it back to you. And that, you know.
No, Brad. It's your business now. If you were to own it. No, this is where I think chefs, and this is an example of me showing how chefs can utilize their skill sets to create jobs that did not exist before. And this is something very important where, as chefs, we have to start defining our own jobs, new jobs, alternate jobs, things that we can do. For example, I think that's a huge niche market. Yo, you could actually create a business where you reach out to chefs with cookbooks and offer them, propose to them, yo, I can revise your cookbook and make the necessary additions to convert your recipes nutritionally. Now, you can show them, you can sell this to a different audience. You're not just selling your cookbook to home cooks, you're selling it to fitness enthusiasts as well. So brand new. This is the thing, we create audiences.
Yeah,
and that's what good business people do. They don't compete over markets. They create markets. And I think that's something that as chefs, we're not dynamic. We're not trained to be that dynamic because look at where we learn in the most rigid conditions.
Yeah.
I can't put butter in this. Absolutely not if it's not on the menu. No, we're trying to be robots and less organic creatures in the kitchen, in the professional industry, or at least in good kitchens. And you find the kitchens that don't have this discipline are not necessarily the most enjoyable ones to work in.
No, exactly. So, you know what? But that's the futures, man. That's what we just got to try and, you know, adapt. Yeah, create these new opportunities. The book I was reading last was the Peter Thiel book, Zero to One. He's the guy who invented, he came up with PayPal. PayPal, yeah, that's where he made his money. So it was basically when eBay was a thing and then he worked out that, people are buying.
PayPal had something to do with eBay, right?
Yeah, I can't remember the full ins and outs.
He did something else as well.
He's done loads of, he's done plenty of stuff, but it was more about how he created that opportunity by realizing, he don't have to create a new a bank. He didn't need to create a shopping system. But if he could put something that would link them two together and make it easier for you and me to go on, and then he embedded it, because at the start you couldn't use eBay without a PayPal account.
You still can.
And that was his brand, you know. He just jumped on that little piggyback and went along for the ride.
Well, okay, but this is the thing that we can see right now. Because, okay, let's put it this way, right? The economy is changing and becoming more efficient. With COVID, a lot of things, high street retail and general shopping is evolving into a more digital, interactive experience. You see it catching up with now, yo. Even I went to my local Chinese Asian supermarket and they hand me a flyer because they own a Chinese restaurant. I figured this flyer is a menu, and it's like, no, this is our link to our app. I'm like, a Chinese grocer has an app where they can now deliver the food to you. They use their own drivers because they have that next door, but the infrastructure is there for them to outsource that to a third party. You have Deliveroo, you have Uber Eats, you have so much more. So I'm like saying, from these new micro industries, because delivery is now a micro industry, that's big things, man. Delivery, transportation and logistics, it's almost become outsourcing, and it creates a new workforce. Because now, and this is going to affect chefs, I think a lot of chefs, And it's not going to affect chefs negatively, but one thing, I don't mean to just make it sound like that, but if you're a chef and you're out of work, you can still deliver. It may not sound sexy, but I know a lot of people who do very well. The problem is that you are accountable for your own income, and it's all based on which no one's just handing you a paycheck. You literally have to travel for your paycheck. But that's fine. That's not a bad thing. And I don't want to say, like, holy shit, Deliveroo, is that really the ceiling for the chefs who are now on the unfortunate end of the pandemic? No, no, there's much more. But if you are in a pinch, because I see so many chefs out there. Like, I saw someone post on one of these Facebook groups today, and it was an empathic call out to their peers to voice their support for the chefs who have been exempted from furlough. Like, there are a lot of chefs who fell through that furlough crack, and we may or may not empathize enough with them, but we should. That could have been so many of us.
Yeah, yeah. 100%.
If you were one of the chefs who, because so easy could have happened in February, guys, hand him a notice, I'm getting a new job. See you.
Yeah, yeah. Done.
Like February, if you handed your notice in last February, what could have been a move of positive development and progression could have put you into what could be one of the hardest years of your life.
Yeah.
And
I've seen that petition. That was a petition going out to sort of just help support those people who have fallen into that very trap. You know, they've changed their job, and then suddenly the job says, we're not here anymore.
But as a business, right, you have to understand, like, what am I going to do? Reemploy this person or just void their termination?
Yeah. Well,
I think maybe some business owners could have been a little bit more, but at that time they couldn't have known. Everyone was die man for thyself, yo. It was all about the fittest, like, yo, I'm trying to float, I'm trying to stay above water as well. And I personally feel for those people more than anyone. Like the people who were not covered by furlough, especially the people who were like saying, "Yeah, you know, it's like, yo, you really didn't do this. Is not self-inflicted. You didn't self-inflict. It's not friendly fire. That's just a fucking roll of the dice. Bad luck of the draw, man. And so many of us are susceptible to little things like that. Like I said, one of the great things about 2020 is it reminded us of our mortality.
100%. Yeah,
how human we are and how much we have to lose and where we stand, like how much is really we control little to nothing.
Yeah, it's all out of our hands,
but we pull together though. I think for the most part, I think as chefs we pull together. Some of it was a bit artificial. I saw a lot of chefs out there, you know, pleading with the society to support their businesses, buy their takeaway meals and blah, blah, blah. And I think these dudes are some hypocritical scumbags because these motherfuckers don't care about people, yo. I'm going to say that. None of them down the line. You walk into one of their kitchens 5 years ago, right, and ask them a question and see how they treat you.
Yeah.
Now they're asking the people to, like, okay, help support us, you know, help us live, keep our industry alive. A lot of us have to be accountable for our roles that we played in destroying this industry that held us up. We cut our noses to spite our face so often, man. When these
people, yeah.
When they had the revolving door of staff, it was out with the old, in with the new. Work that one until he's dead. If he's useless to you, chuck him out. Care not about anything to do with him.
Yeah. No,
we're not going to have chefs in a couple of years. Why? Because they have opportunities. The chefs in them that were just filling the gaps, so many chefs just filled essential gaps to keep the industry afloat. These guys were not looked after, no. They've looked after themselves. They'll never come back.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm gonna segue a little bit here because that you're bringing me on to another subject, which was one of the blogs I was writing just before the pandemic, and this is where it got completely blown out of the water. Was mm-hmm. There was some momentum coming in for the 4-day week.
Yeah. Lord, I know it's desired. Oh, go ahead, start. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead. Talk it.
But this was it. It was like. Oh, and I was thinking, okay, the 4-day week and bringing that in, because I think in Scandi countries, they were bringing this in, and there's a lot of people pushing for it, and in Denmark, sweet.
Fat Baines was one of the first people to do it here in the UK.
Yeah. And I'd started designing my rotors thinking, okay, this can work, because we're doing 12-hour days anyway. And I was thinking, okay, I mean, for the head chef, it's going to be something, because you can't disappear for 3 days of the week. But especially if you're open 7 days a week, you know.
Okay, now this is the problem, right?
Yeah.
And this is why, because I work somewhere now that's adopted the 4-day, would never go back to 7.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because when you look at it, right, first of all, operating over 7 days, you have to account for the fact that during those extra 3 days of operation, not many of them are high traffic trading periods. If you close Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, how busy were you? And for the trade and revenue that you would make being open for those days, is it justified by the proportional operating costs and overheads and staffing levels to make those 3 days viable? Yeah. In the end, you're only losing probably about 2% maybe on your gross revenue or profit margins. Maybe if you keep everything else in check.
Yeah.
But you know what you don't have control over when you open 7 days anymore? You don't have a fixed food cost. What I find with a 4-day working week is that I have an almost fixed weekly food cost.
Yeah.
It doesn't vary much different week to week because I'm running out of stuff. I'm only open 4 days. I'm not ordering for the fifth. So I want to know, okay, how much do I need for these 4 days to get me to this point? At which point, Sunday night, I'm fine. I'm doing no more tea bass, yo. It is what it is. I'm closed tomorrow. I chuck it away, which is fine. Then you force them to buy other things. And this is the thing. This window of where you have more control of going from 7 days to 4, it creates scarcity. And this scarcity, no, people can't come here. They can't come here. They have to come here. So everyone who used to be like, oh, I want a Saturday night table or I won't come. And we're busy Saturday night. We're fully booked every Saturday night. So no, if you do your part still to keep the food standard high, offer a good product, good value, they'll still want to come. No, they know, like, well, look here. Well, you can try for 2 weeks from now, Saturday. Oh, no. You can try for maybe next week, Thursday afternoon or Thursday night, which is when they would like to. But then they're like, oh, or we have this table tomorrow night, Sunday night. Well, I'll take that. No, I get the table.
I get that. No, and that's what I get. And I get that. And that's 100%. That's what I'm feeling that. I mean, it's different. It works differently for restaurants and it works differently for pubs. And obviously hotels and
hotels. Oh my gosh! I think pubs can adopt the same model, but you know where pubs can because I always said that I truly believe that there's more money to be made in a pub than a restaurant, my man.
Yeah, well,
pubs, you know, come on, man. There is, yo. You get drink trade in a restaurant. Yeah. In a restaurant, right? Your drink and food trade is split. I'd say 70% food, 30% drinks.
Yeah.
Pubs, though, that shit is almost
50. It depends because Obviously, I've been both sides. So I work for pubs which are tied to a brewery.
Small menus, yo, big chef right there hit the nail on the head. Small menus. I'm with you on that. Big
and that's what we did. So in the run up to the pandemic, in those weeks where we knew we were shutting at the end of the week, the menu got shrunk down, and like you said, no sea bass. So
people are okay with it. But this is where we started to think for ourselves. Okay, so why were we doing so much to make sure that we have everything in stock all the time? Because we thought that the customer had too much power in a pre-COVID world. The restaurant has taken a bit of power. And the government took a little bit of power. Man, it was beautiful when they were saying, yo, guys, out the fucking door at 10 o'clock. Man, you know how easy that was? And the funny thing is, I'm telling you, no matter how much we shrunk and put more restrictions in, our revenue never changed that much. Our revenue, maybe slightly, but it would slowly even itself out. And where the revenue changes, your operating costs change as well. So while you have a smaller pie, right, the final piece that you get is bigger. A bigger piece of a smaller pie is much better than a small piece of a big one. I'm telling you, this is where we don't get. Thoughts on younger chefs getting in kitchens before 15? You want to take that one, bro?
Mate, well, I started... when did I start? I started when I was... No, my first job, I was 15. Yeah, I was 15, 16, 16. So, yeah, do it, man. Because, I mean, I take on work experience. I take on, you know, school kids, like when at school work experience. I've had 13 and 14-year-olds in my kitchen. And only for like literally a little block of time. And I always laugh because those guys can't stand up. You know, they cannot stand. And when I say they can't stand up, they cannot. They're not used to being on their feet for more than an hour.
First of all, what I think I didn't get into the professional cooking industry until I was significantly later, closer to 30 than 15. But what I would say is that, and it's funny that someone asked, do I think you should get into it in the kitchen? Hey, I don't think there's anything wrong with being exposed to the environment as early as possible. Would I tell you to go and do a Saturday night shift under no circumstances? It's no place for a young... I don't think so. Maybe you can get them like... No, I don't think a 15-year-old human being needs to be in a... You should be doing something else. You with?
Yeah.
If your parents want you to get a little bit of pocket money, I'll bring you in, but I'm only going to let you... I'm going to ask your parents, oh, he's only going to peel potatoes. He's not going to be useful to me.
Yeah.
So if you want me to just put some pocket change in his hand, sure, but I'm not going to put any pressure on this guy. If he wants to learn, sure, that's good, but he could also get in the way. Could be a liability. Yeah. 15 years old, like you said, I'm not here to babysit. There's sharp objects. There's fire. There's heat.
Yeah, yeah. We take the youngsters on... A lot of local kids, especially like washing up in the sink, they'll come in and do 2-3 hours. And I think it's good to expose them to a working environment. Yeah. And, you know.
They can do that. Hey, the passion levels, you're right. Which is a funny question because my girl was watching MasterChef Junior in Spain, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever watched it?
No, I can't do that. I can't watch it. Stretch me out.
Some of these little kids are right? But then I'm 9, 10, 11, right? And my girls, they're like, hey, look, some of these dudes are better than you. And I said, bro, watch your fucking mouth, right? Because let me tell you something, right? Under no circumstances, I asked a question on my polls. Is it possible that there is a 9-year-old chef in the world or a 9-year-old person in the world who can cook better than you? Just a general question. Some people said, I worded the answers correctly. Yeah. One of them was, maybe, which is fair. Maybe there could be. The other one was absolutely not. Respect to the man from them out there that said absolutely not, right? Because if y'all think I'm going to let anybody 11 years old, I'm hardly letting a 30-year-old cook better than me. We don't fight.
But this is where you have to break it down, though, right? Because I've seen some kids produce some amazing, like brilliant food, like you say on TV, or that's a one dish in a practice environment where all day. Yeah, no, they're not gonna be better.
We cook like Black Panther. We cook forever. And when I see things getting a little bit hot for you and you start get tired, I throw a fucking pork shoulder on your back. Yo, God, dude, let's go. Let's get this stew on. Let's get this stew on. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go, chat. Yeah. Let's go. I start drinking water, man. I'm cheating. Yo, this kid has no chance, man. I'm killing him. And I'm just saying, that's because I want to win. And I'm saying, like, and that's where I believe that everyone else who said, absolutely not. They would not let no kid beat them, and I believe them. But it's like you say, okay, so you watch sports and basketball or whatever, football. You ever see where the kids go play with the professionals? And they bring them along. Come on, we'll let you play with us for a while. And these professional athletes play these kids like professional athletes. Push them down, jump over them, throw their shit, and then teach them. Me personally, if a kid wants to compete with me, I encourage you to bring it. You gotta play with your team. You gotta beat me with your chest, right? You got 8-year-old kids out there thinking that I'm gonna sit here and let you all cook me. Absolutely not. No way. I'm just saying, yo, let's get to this question, man. I'm sorry, I'm passionate about the kids.
No, I love your passion, man. I love it when you go off.
I'm telling you, yo, kids, I beat kids in cooking competitions too. I think I'm gonna let a kid beat me just for the encouragement? Nah, man.
So how competitive are you though, Kareem?
I'm very competitive. Immense.
Yeah, I'm getting that vibe. I'm getting that vibe.
I don't lose. I lose, yo. And this is the thing, right? Let me tell you something about me, right? I have taken some of the most historical L's in life. Like, my L's in them big, like movie budget. My L's in them big. The losses I take in life are massive, but I keep coming back.
Yeah.
I am too naive to quit. And that's what I'm saying. You know, even if you beat me, it makes me better. Are you mad? Even if you beat me, it makes me better. Because I am infuriated, and I am destined to prove you wrong. Yo, the worst thing that can happen to me is the best thing that can happen to me, and it's that I disappoint myself. If I disappoint myself, I do everything to rectify that. It's very unhealthy, but it works for me.
Yeah, that's the thing, and it works for you, because I
don't recommend this for everyone. I'm not going to go out and tell everyone, like, yo, I'm going to start playing basketball with kids and jumping and putting my foot in their chest. Nah, that's it. Don't do that. I never said that. What I said, everyone with a passion and competition. Like, just measure yourself, measure your competitive spirit, and apply it in life. That's what it's speaking of. Let's get the question, man.
So this is somebody just started following. I don't know if it's you or me, but
both of us.
You just give yourself a little intro, man. I'm just like, let people know who you are. Not that you need any more followers.
Support.
So tell us where you work.
Broke Dinner, head chef, restaurant, Trinity in Cambridge. Born in England, grew up in Antigua, lived in the US for a while, and I've been back here in the UK for the last 10 years. I started cooking in my mid-20s, 26, and here I am. I'll tell you guys my age. I'm embracing it. I'm great now. I'm 40 in a few months, man. I'm freaking 40, dog. I love it, and I'm trying to fight age with everything. Like, I'm actually using collagen. And yo, shout out to black people for using collagen. collagen shots and them things, right? Yo, this is why we don't crack, or they say, right? Because you eat chicken skin, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
hey, all the chicken.
Oh, that's where all the collagen is, though, bro.
Yeah, this is it. Don't be giving away our secrets, man.
I'm here. I'm putting the chicken in the eat it. Or because they have to get past that. Ew, the chicken skin. You know, I eat that stuff boiled. I eat that stuff stewed. I eat that stuff crispy. You know, I make chicken stock soup. But when you think about it, we make soup out of it. That fat that's on that we don't skim. You know, I think that is a part of our self-care that we overlook, our diet. It's like, for example, we don't use much butter in our country. We use other things which are worse, but butter. And I think butter is something that actually catalyzes the aging process, in my opinion. What do I know? I'm just there.
That's it. I know. So a bit about who am I?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm Brian. Yeah, Knife of Brian. That's my business, and that's my sort of social media presence. I write blogs and I sort of write articles for various sort of networks. But how I know Kareem is through, especially through Staff Canteen as well. There's a bit of connection through that.
Yeah, book about Staff Canteen and
everything. Yeah, big shout out to Staff Canteen. But I'm the head chef at the Greyhound in Ipswich. Adnams, you know, very much a beer-led pub, but it's about 50-50 to be fair. But it's, I'm 46, 47.
You're 46 and 47 and still look so young.
I don't even know. I stopped counting at 40. That's
Gareth Jenkins is asking a very provocative question here. Is olive oil white people oil? Gareth, listen here. I don't partake in those segregated comments. Olive oil should speak for itself. And if I was olive oil, I would say I belong to all the people in them, but I belong to the girls them first. I think olive oil belongs to the girls them. Like, if we're going to give olive oil to someone, give it to the girls them. I can't stand olive oil. Do you like olive oil?
I like olive oil. I know I've never understood the dipping olive oil in bread thing.
Bread and butter work. Bread and
butter. Yeah, bread and butter. Yeah. We started doing it a while back, man. It's like when I was at the bistro, little bits of olive oil and balsamic, and people were dipping it. And I was like, I don't get that, man. Just give me some butter.
And olives as well. I think olives is such a waste, man, food. Like, you can just sit on there and eat olives. Do something better with your life. It's like chewing gum.
Whoa. See, now I love olives, man. I can sit there just yam them all day long. Olives, really? Yeah, I don't mind olives, man. I get vexed when I get when I get stoned and that, because that minute broke my teeth and it's like, that's what I get.
No, this is the thing, right? You talk about that. I broke a tooth today for the first time ever in my life. Like, I had a bit of a moment there where I thought it was going to be something else. So I'm eating and I feel, I'm like, so I don't know. I don't know. When you feel that, you know something's wrong. I spit everything out of my hand and I'm like, I panicked a little bit and then I don't know. Why do you have to be in these situations, right? I'm still cool, but I start sweating profusely, and then I don't know what happens, and then I check, and there's no blood. So once you see no blood, I was kind of okay. I did what anyone in my position would do, and I seek the proper advice, and I went on Google.
Google
said good doctor, so I went and got some things, but I'm still measuring it. So it's funny.
Here's my advice, man. Don't ever go on Google for anything, man. I had a sore finger, right?
Yeah, sore finger. It's a wisdom tooth, man. I don't want to talk about it, man.
Yeah, they'll snap your neck and to get in there and take them all out.
Yeah, but I have impacted molars, man. Like, I need to have surgery on my.
You can have, yeah, you are. That's what I did, man. They went in. They had it all four, like, out. I had to go under, like, surgery.
Was it painful? After the recovery?
Yes. Yeah, I was all right, man, because, you know, I'm hard, man. That's all right.
You're hard and them things, right?
mate. The worst bit for me was I was under general anaesthetic. So general. And I remember when I came round, I don't know what happened, right? But all I remember is I was hitting on every single nurse in the theatre. I was like, hey, I don't know. I was like possessed by Casanova or something. I was like, how you doing? I had a gown on. My ass was hanging out. I was looking rough, dribbling.
I don't think you can blame the anesthesia. You're West Indian, right? West Indians always think it's the right time to trouble.
I don't know. I was trying to.
You could be getting arrested. You start laughing, like, yo, son, you're going to jail, dog. Will you laugh with a I'm gonna tell you something that's interesting about England, though. Like, I mean, apparently, I don't know, but you know, England actually has okay looking policemen. Well, then again, I don't know. They got them IG accounts with them gal from Brazil. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, if you see them kind of things, but whatever, whatever. Broken not big enough. Here we go. Yo, Gareth, no, it was fine. It was fine right there. It was fine. Well, I was eating, and it wasn't even nothing invasive. I was eating. I wasn't eating like olives or nothing hard, like what?
You're falling apart, get on. That's what happens when you get to 40.
Yo, oh my gosh, here we go. Can I have a recipe for your haggis with the pressed potatoes? Yeah, bro, I'll shoot you that afterwards. But that's so easy. All it is, you just get potatoes, you layer, and then you press the haggis on top. You just slice the haggis, and then you put it on top. Because haggis is already cooked. Potatoes have the starch, it has the fat, so you don't need any butter. The fat from the haggis will set it up and just cook it, press it after, chill it down, and so easy, yo. There is
I'll tell you what, I am glad that Big Chef brought that up, right? Because when I saw that dish, that was phenomenal. That's one of my favorite things that you've done, man. And
to you for saying that. Because I think for me as well, I like that because okay. I like to be creative, right? But the thing about creativity is that your creativity, to be truly creative, that's a lot of pressure on yourself, right? So you don't have to be creative in an entire dish. I believe that a good dish, you just need one element to be creative.
Yeah. No, I like that.
The rest of that dish is so basic. You have bean stew. Holy shit, it don't get no more basic than bean stew.
Yeah.
You have a piece of rabbit that is not even colored. It's literally, you can call it boiled in oil. You literally just can't get boiling oil. But you're distracting them from that by just the... And the potato press, it's just a heritage potato. And just something like that. And this is where I want to teach. I want to speak to people because I truly believe that anyone can be creative. You just have to exercise your creative muscles. And most of the time, exercising your creative muscles is just an extension of substitution, replacement, and lateral rearranging of things that are already established. Okay? Like, I'll go through a little creative exercise here. You take, for example... It's like I did with the rabbit noodle soup, right?
Yeah.
That is essentially chicken noodle soup. Rabbit tastes like chicken. It's a clear soup. The noodles are like any noodles. But if you change the flavoring, it becomes rabbit udon or rabbit ramen because I use an udon noodle. So you start to see like, wow, it's something that's not brand new at all. But just the sound of it. Look, just the sound. Rabbit noodle soup. Creativity starts in just saying things, right? And once you say something, you make it happen. Okay, for example, another creative aspect, okay? And it's I see all root vegetables as being the same thing.
Yeah.
All potatoes are the same. And by an extension, they're similar to the root vegetables we get in the Caribbean, like cassava, yam. What difference is the starch levels in them, sugar content. But essentially, they all behave the same way. They all. You have to manipulate them. So when you think about a triple cooked potato chip, you can do triple cook yam.
Yeah.
Anything that you can do with a potato, and even worse with eggs. So now, okay, let's say potatoes, right? How many different things can you do with a potato, bro?
No,
I think maybe 50 maybe.
It's more than that, man.
More, right?
Yeah.
So when you think about that, that means you can do 100 things if you substitute them with, for example, sweet potato, right?
Yeah.
That's 100 things. So you go from knowing how to do 50 things to know by just applying it. Because you can do like French fry, sweet potato fries, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just fix it around, but that's still a different thing. So now, with every ingredient that you have, just through substitutions, you double your repertoire. If you can compare it to something, anything that I can do with chicken, let's say I can do 20 things with chicken, right? So I know how to do 20 dishes.
Yeah.
I can do them all with turkey as well. So no, my 20 is actually 40. So then hot and sour chicken makes sense. So in theory, hot and sour teal or hot and sour partridge makes sense. Because hot and sour chicken makes sense. So then you get the orange, and then you think about, it's about conjoining. So I have the chicken, which is now going to be partridge. And I have that idea of hot and sour because I've already said it. And this is it. Sometimes it's just blurting out the most random things. Like I just said, hot and sour chicken. Now I'm thinking hot and sour partridge. When I get hot and sour chicken, what do they have in there? Bell peppers, yeah? And pineapple. Or, so with peppers, I can make peperonata, which is essentially the same thing as caramelized onions with peppers. Yeah. Just sweet chicken. So no, in my mind, I'm already seeing the hot and sour chicken on the plate. In whatever, I see the hot and sour chicken here, and I see right here the peperonata. So I'm seeing the two things now, but I'm not getting the connection between hot and sour and the dish as yet. Just the peperonata. It's missing something. It's missing the sour element.
Yeah.
So now I just need acidity. What am I using for this acidity? I don't know why, but I think grapefruit, because it pops to my mind, and I thought about the hot and sour. So I need to do something with grapefruit, maybe a grapefruit gastric. There we go. So I cook my hot and sour partridge in grapefruit gastric with the peperonata, and then what? Maybe I'll make an egg roll out of something because it feels like a Chinese dish, and just change it. But you see how you just evolve a dish and create by just substituting and breaking down the elements and putting them in different places.
You know what, mate? I just feel honored that I just had a little sit down inside Broke Dinner's head just then. No.
But I say this is something that anyone can do, and you can do it repeatedly, after ingredient, after ingredient, after ingredient. Okay, for example, macaroni and cheese, right? Why do you have to use macaroni? You don't. So then you can use an Asian noodle.
Yeah.
No, you can. And depending on what part of Asia you go to, there's a regional cheese. I'm sure there's cheese in Asia, whatever. You could do so it's just about applying things to different regions. Like cooking begins with regions and substitutions, and that's all that creativity is. That's literally all that creativity is. Very logical and lateral substitutions. Once you realize that, holy shit, I can do this for anything. Yes. And you'll never run out. You'll never, ever, ever run out. Because easily, right? So we said there, hot and sour partridge. What if I had chosen to go with Peking duck? Well, maybe I need to make Peking chicken instead. So you reverse the process, and then I go down a whole other rabbit hole. I change the glaze. Instead of using that red glaze, maybe I use Korean or red chili.
Yeah.
Because in Chinese cooking, they use a dye on their food. Do you know that? They use a red food coloring to get that. Not everywhere, but some of them do. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I think it originates as a natural dye. Isn't that a flower?
It's not a natto. It's something else. But they use a dye. They do use a dye. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Now, what I like to do as well is to reverse engineer those processes. And for example, like I said, if they use a dye, it's like saffron. That's the part of biryani that lends it to color, right? But in Peruvian cooking, they use a lot of, they don't use saffron, they use yellow food coloring. They literally use yellow food coloring in their food, with their dishes, their color. So now I can enhance Peruvian dishes by substituting that yellow food coloring with saffron. And it's not a Peruvian dish anymore. It's a brand new entity. And then when you remove the saffron, then I can use turmeric. And then if I use turmeric, I can compound it and elevate it to a dish from more of an Indian region. So it's important to continue traveling. And whenever you are creating a dish, you have to imagine wherever in the world this could be eaten. Because I do believe that there are still new things, but I believe that anything that you do is familiar to something that has been done somewhere already.
There's very few new dishes.
I think that there are new combinations, very new. I think there are things that have never been done before, but I think we underestimate how much has been done.
I mean, I've just recently purchased a couple of old cookbooks, and some of the things in there, I'm thinking, oh my Lord, gee, what the... They're putting these wild birds with the fruits that you'd never think. You know, they love quince. They love quince. The quince was in everything.
And I'm telling you, it's like I was looking through. I have old cookbooks all over. I still, particularly, I like the Elizabeth David books a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And Agnes Marshall and Mary Betty, or what was that one? What was it? I read a lot. I have Julia Child cookbooks. I remember my mom's Julia Child cookbooks.
Yeah.
And these things, oh man, particularly when people used to visit India and wrote original Indian cookbooks. Because back then, you know, difficult. It's one thing to get a French recipe from a French chef, but I don't know, to get a recipe from an old Indian grandmother, you're never going to get that. It's like getting a recipe from an old black woman. What recipe? put little of that.
Yeah.
Okay, then you boil it, and then you know you're listening, and you see when it's ready. I'm like, okay, so what? How much is a little? Lick a bit. That's what it is. You can't quantify that. How are we coping with the lockdown? Lockdown is okay. The first lockdown that we had was amazing. The second lockdown, not so amazing. This one, I don't know.
Yeah.
It becomes a little bit different for me. I don't enjoy it as much.
Are you going into work at all? Have you been into work?
Who, me? I was there today. I went in for a meeting with the owner just to see about where we're going in the future.
Yeah.
See what's happening. So far, we're optimistic. But I don't know. We don't know.
And did you open at all during the last lockdown? Did you do takeaways or did you do anything?
We don't, which is odd enough. I don't know. They don't want to do it. That's fine. I use the time to read, to plan. I try to do other things. I try to catch up on the bulk programming, which I love. I watch every single food program you can imagine on any streaming platform. Am I a Marvel fan? Absolutely. Big time.
I see. These questions are firing. I knew the answer to that one. I knew you were a comic book guy.
Big comic book fan, yo. I'm disappointed I don't get enough comic book discussions in this side of the world with chefs. Because that's the thing. I am not interested in a lot of things. I can talk about food quite some bit. I can talk about basketball a bit. I like music. But comic books and general nerd culture like that, I can talk about comic books at great length. Sci-fi, I'm okay with. I'm a big-time comic book guy, big-time. Because I'm telling you, this is where when we talk about reading and writing and creativity, I contribute some of my personal penchants for all of the above into my strong ties to enjoying comic books. So the things that these guys can make happen with paper, and the stories that they can tell in 28 pages, 23 now, but when I was a kid, it was 28 pages. The stories they can tell and the feelings and the emotions that they can carve. And just the sense of realism, danger, and oh my gosh, the scale of their writing. Like most people who write on Earth-based novels, like non-fiction, they keep it very contained. But when you have the whole universe as an expanse, you go so far, and then comic books go into parallel universes, multiple dimensions, alternate histories, possible futures, synchronized timelines and stories. Like, if you guys think movies like Tenet and Inception were high concept, these things have nothing on some of the comic books that I've read, man.
You just mentioned Tenet there. I've just watched that twice.
What you thought about that?
I enjoyed the film. Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, I enjoyed the film because I like a film that challenged me to think, what's going on. But then there's... When it comes to anything based on time travel...
There's too much day smacking out. It's not really time travel, is it?
It's reverse. But I'm like thinking, no, I'm with it, and then it loses me. And I'm like, okay, now I'm gone.
It loses me so much, right? Okay, so Inception, and this is what I like about Christopher Nolan as a director. He likes high concept, and he's very, very ambitious with his screenwriting. Shout out to him on that. But his movies have a certain formula where there's always one device or concept that you just have to take on absolute faith. And this concept, the entire movie will be hinged on this, that you just have to take on faith. And if you really think about this concept alone, it erodes everything around the movie.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen, okay, like for example, Inception, right? There was that machine that would send you in the dreams, right?
Yeah.
What was the machine? It was a box or something?
Oh, it was a box.
A box, right? That could send you in dreams, right? All right, there was a box. All right. Have you seen The Prestige?
Yeah, yeah.
That was a gorgeous movie. My first.
Yeah, the magicians. Yeah,
that was my favorite Christopher Nolan movie. And he had that, a box, right? He had a box that could just turn you into two people, right? Don't worry, the machine just works, okay? And then Tenet, they had this round box that you go in.
Yeah. And you know what? I hadn't realized that The Prestige was a Christopher Nolan film. So, yeah.
Beautiful, of course, the same concept. And you look at it, the writing, and in most of his movies, the story is given away in certain contexts throughout the movie, and they're open. It's open to a lot of impression. I personally think that The Prestige was his best movie by far, because I'll tell you, and one thing that I respect about him, his movies benefit from repeat viewings. But no movie benefits. If you remember Memento, that was cool. That was cool. Inception was okay. I thought that Inception was a good movie. But, oh man, when you think about The Prestige, right? You can watch The Prestige the first time and not get it. And even though, if you remember The Prestige, the premise of the movie was given away at the beginning when the little boy saw him kill the bird and said, and he showed him the bird. No, it's fine. He's like, no. You kill the bird. That's the bird's brother. I thought that was genius when they said that in the very beginning of the movie. And then towards the end of the movie, you realize that, holy shit. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
They're two brothers, right?
Yeah.
When you watch the movie the second time, knowing that they're two brothers and they each loved a different woman, right?
Yeah,
you can see the differences in their personality.
One
is called Fred, and one is called one is called Freddie, and one is called Alfred. And sometimes they would refer to, and one of them was with his wife, and the other one was with the Scarlett Johansson. When she would say things to him, like, and he'd say, "You love me, I love you," and she would say, "You don't mean it today." That's because you could see who she was talking to, the other brother. And more interestingly than that, there was a scene where they first saw Angier, Professor Angier's the great Danton's trick, and their mind was blown. Like when they saw him, he was arguing almost, it seemed like himself, where he's like, "Why can't you figure this out? Why can't you figure this trick? He's a better magician than you. You just need to let the trick go. You just need to let him." And he seems almost schizophrenic, but you see him having an argument with his brother. On a second viewing, that movie literally becomes the premise. It becomes magical. I thought that was an amazing movie to watch. Let's see, here we go with this question. As a solo chef who cooks from home, how do I go about making steps to create my own restaurant?
Get the money. Oh, mate. Yeah, it's money.
Get the money. Get the money. I would never even encourage anyone to open their own restaurant.
I can even advise anybody right now. Right now, I just say keep doing what you're doing at this, you know, by moving into the pop-ups was starting to gather momentum again.
You know, I would do if I would, and this is my advice to anyone who's thinking about it. Like, there's a young chef, that messages me a lot. Nathan something, he was in the chat here. Yo, this kid is 15 years old and he is a very ambitious cook. Looking at what he does as a 15-year-old cook, I think one day he could be the greatest chef ever. I'm going on a limb here. I'm 15 years old, and he's always hounding me and pestering me for recipes. I thought the dude was like in his 20s before I found out he's 15. And I was, shit, you want all these recipes, dog? All right, whatever, I'll give them to him. He was asking, what should he do? He wants to start working. I'm like saying, yo, if you have your foot in the game this age, as a young chef, what I would tell you guys is screw, if you have the time now, don't worry about working if you don't have to. I would just say start creating content and building yourself a profile somewhere, a digital profile. Because everything, build yourself a brand. In the future, you won't need to be a restaurant chef. I don't know how many really, really professional food bloggers and content creators there are out there in the food industry. And the best ones out there are not necessarily the best chefs.
100%.
Not taking a shot at any chefs or any home cooks or anything, but we serve different audiences, man.
Yeah, yeah.
It's even within the ranks of being chefs. I don't make sushi or sashimi. And that shit sells off. I don't cook vegan food. That shit sells off. And it's about understanding the audience that you have the strongest relationship with. If I was a young cook right now, I would build a very strong connection with an audience that I curate yesterday, that I start building, and an organic audience. I start to get, I would make it my job. Set a goal for yourself and screw owning a restaurant. Get to know 10,000 people that like what you do. And you won't need a restaurant. 10,000 people. In this day and age, this is an option, though. You can find a million people.
So many options, man. And that is the thing. I was part of a lecture the other day, a school visit, and I was talking to, college. And it was about just trying to inform these guys that as a chef, you don't have to be a chef in a pub, in a restaurant, in a hotel now. You can be whatever you want. You can, like you just said, have that social media presence. And people will come to you. You could be you could be a chef and, you know, people say, oh, I want a dinner party or I want your recipe. You can sell your recipes. You can sit on a screen and sell your recipes and make the money that restaurant's making.
I think in about 10 to 15 years, once the infrastructure and the technology advances enough for the delivery model and satellite kitchens become a little bit more scaled upwards, I think there will be that service where you'll find someone, because you look at it, right? The problem is that you have someone out there like a food blogger, she's vegan, or he's like a barbecue guy, has 200,000 supporters on IG or an audience of 200,000. But he doesn't know how to monetize a product to get to them. They post his recipes or she posts their recipes, 500 people like, or 1,000, 2,000 people like, 400 people comment, 120 people, 150 people save the post. There's genuinely proof that this guy has an audience that wants a product from him, and that product is a recipe. How do we monetize that and get a product in front of people? I think at some point the infrastructure will be elegant enough where you can send your recipe to a satellite kitchen and the rest is up to the Amazon of food.
Yeah. You can see that lot of chefs working in a big Amazon warehouse with unlimited supply of ingredients.
Imagine a big warehouse that's open 24 hours a day with delivery, because the infrastructure is there. They get food. The logistics of Amazon, you get something around the world in less than 12 hours, though, no?
Yeah.
Okay, 24. 24 hours to get something around the world right now. Yo, I can leave stock in my fridge frozen and it won't defrost in that time.
So what we're saying here, this is an exclusive. So in 10 years from now, I can be sitting there thinking, oh, you know what? I always fancied that hot and sour partridge with and it we go put it into my pad.
But then exactly all I have to do, okay, now what I would have to do is create the demand for this hot and sour partridge with the pepperonata and the grapefruit gastric. Don't worry, I'm gonna write this down. The hot and sour partridge, I said it here, right? All I have to do is create a scalable recipe. And as chefs, this is where as chefs, yo, we have the, I can write a recipe that's easy to follow. And if there are chefs, and I truly believe that in the future, for chefs to really translate their skills, they have to possess two skills that they don't really fine tune. One is writing a recipe. Two, following a recipe. We don't really do either of those things as much as we should. But in the future, to be valuable as a part of the system, unless you are a leader, if you just want to be assimilated into the workforce, you could improve those two dimensions of your skill set and make yourself even more valuable. Because I do believe that it will come to that point, because ghost kitchens are popping up everywhere, man.
Yeah.
Satellite kitchens, it's just a matter of time before they're all uniquely or very, very neatly put in a system that maximizes their reach globally. It's just too much of a wild, wild west thing right now, every man for themselves. Just take one visionary dictator to be like, no, you guys need to do it all together this way, and this is what we're going to do. The infrastructure is there.
You're right.
Freezers, And I think that would work, because then you think about it. Then imagine that, because I follow some people from way around the world. I'm like, I would love to have your food. If they were to be able to say, guys, guess what? You can have my food now. You have my money.
Yeah, mate.
People would spend that money, yo. No, then imagine that. Now you have influencer chefs, true influencer chefs. Not no joke influence food. Not no joke thing where it's like, oh, let me take a picture with this burger. Or, oh, look at this. I'm going to cook this dish. Look at this puree. It's amazing. No, this means nothing. I make zero money on Instagram. Yeah. None. I make nothing. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that it will forever be like that. Or that doesn't mean that this is the end of the buck doesn't end here. I think it continues to evolve. And it's important for us to continually envision it evolving and changing and to understand the potential reach of chefs in the future. Because once again, maybe none of this ever happens. But if it doesn't happen, it's because no one tries. That's the only reason it doesn't. If it doesn't happen, and I'm telling you, the guy who tries and makes it work, I 1,000% guarantee he won't be a chef.
Yeah, it'd be something. But you've got the idea. Now, somebody listening to this right now is writing this idea down, and they'll be the Jeff. They'll be buying out Jeff Bezos.
But this is what I'm saying. But the world benefits. The world benefits, and I think that we could all use that. I think we definitely all need that. We need food to take that true evolutionary step into the future, because we still, you know, food has remained relatively unchanged, or the service model of the restaurant has remained relatively unchanged in about the last, what, 20, 30 years?
Yeah, mate.
40, 50? When's the last time we had a big change? McDonald's, fast food was the last big change.
Okay,
Deliveroo.
I was going to say, the delivery industry is sort of really, I mean, it's saved a lot of pubs, a lot of restaurants.
But this didn't happen as a necessity. And that's the thing, COVID forced a lot of necessary evolution that should have been by design and not by default. We really should have been forced into change from within. We should have changed. But whatever, I still think it doesn't matter the message or the messenger. It's still as long as it gets there in the end. But although I can't express my sympathies enough for everyone who has been affected by COVID. We've all been affected by COVID, but I do think this is necessary, man. I was affected before COVID. The industry affected us all before COVID. I just think that the problem was that we had jobs, so we didn't really value our time. We didn't value ourselves. We weren't valued. We were the lowest ranked in the restaurant industry. I kid you not. The cooks were the lowest rank of human being in the food service industry. Like, they were beneath the chefs, because the chefs in a restaurant, the chefs treated everyone like shit above them. The chefs in my kitchens I've worked in, the chefs have always respected and treated the KPs nicer than the cooks. Have you not seen that? You've seen that, right? What is that?
Yeah, but this is a... I'll be honest, I don't allow that sort of shit in my kitchen.
Okay, you don't. I think you are the few and far between. Front of house management generally has no respect or relationship with folks.
Yeah.
Just with the team. Front of house managers even less, and even less owners, when I know for a fact that the most important part of a business, of a restaurant, is the cooks. Not the chef, but the cooks.
Yeah.
Not the owner, but the cooks. Not the runners, but the cooks. I'm even going to go as far as to say not everyone together, just the cooks.
Why? Yeah, that's controversial.
It's controversial, but it's real. As soon as we accept that, right? There's a difference between you in the industry. You have to realize who's the jockey and who's the racehorse, right? Like, the racehorse, the people who do the work, is the cooks. No, they lift the business. Okay, let's put it this way. In a situation, okay, let's say all but one front of house member is sick. We can still do something, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be tough, but we can make this. Maybe one of us will have to carry out the plate tonight. But that's a solution. Like, okay, chefs, we'll carry the food out. I've eaten in places where the chefs bring the food to your table. I've eaten I've eaten in places like that. No, I've never eaten in places where the waiters cook, or the front house cook, or they can.
Well, it's controversial because I've worked.
Why are we afraid to value ourselves? We've been belittled for so long, taking minimum wages for most of our career until we can make an affordable wage for a very small window until our backs or knees give out, and then we're replaced by someone much younger who's going to perpetuate the cycle even further into entropy. It ends chaotically, man. Yeah. I'm going to put a very grim picture in front of you. What happens to cooks in their 50s?
It's not good.
What happens? Nobody knows what happens. Where do chefs die?
you don't use Fosca's here. Yeah. Our fruit and veg supplier you don't use Fosca's out that way?
Yeah, no, but I've seen them.
And if you go to their warehouse and the prep rooms where all the veg has been prepped, it's like a load of hot old head chefs in there, man. That's where they are.
Well, really, dude, is that our swan song? Is that the swan song we deserve?
Well, nah, but it's.
Are we going to look after ourselves? What is it? Is the onus on us to educate ourselves about financial? Do we need, as a part of a chef, do we need a plan for how to exit the industry as well?
Yeah, no, we do. And, you know, I've written about that before as well. You do need an exit plan, an exit strategy. What you need to start thinking about. And you need to start thinking about it early, in your 30s.
The exit plan takes about 15 years to start. Like, the exit plan goes into effect it takes 15 years, you know, to plan out or to actually enact from start to finish. It takes about 10 years minimum.
Yeah, yeah.
The exit plan, you don't say, okay, I exit in 1 year. No, you start exiting.
No, I feel, you know, I mean, I feel I've started late and I've had this plan of going to, you know, go back to uni for a while, but, you know, to implement this plan, I know I've got to do 4 years of study now. But hopefully at the end of that, I'll have my exit strategy. But for, I feel a lot of chefs, then you need to make that plan now, you know, before.
A lot of chefs have that entrepreneurial bone in them. A lot of us as chefs, we rely too much on establishments and we don't know how to become establishments. I'll tell you, right? There's a chef, right, who during quarantine, I don't know, I think he was in a situation where, shit, he got quarantined, he had some cash, but I don't think he was on furlough, I'm not sure, but whatever he did, he's like, fuck it, I'm going to start selling sandwiches to man's in the Roma M. Sandwiches, afternoon tea, and little things. Oh, in no time, in less than a year, this dude got two vans running his area, yo. Preparing fine dining food. In his block, and he started off with sandwiches, and he's like, "Yo, I got two men and I got staff now." How ridiculous is that? Just on inspiration and just on will. And what he did, it sounded so, watching it happen in real time, just leveraging social media, selling his shit online on Instagram and Facebook, and letting people know, "Yo, creating his demand, saying to people like, yo, look at the dates and them filling out. I got one or two spots here. I got this menu here. I don't have this much more. This week full out. This month full out." Just creating a demand. He could have been lying and bullshitting, but he's growing.
Yeah.
Now, these are things that us as chefs, we need to see and understand that there is still opportunity and avenues out there for us outside of the restaurant.
And you have to want it. You have to want it. You know,
to want it more than anyone. And no one's going to hold your hand. Unfortunately, no one is going to hold your hand.
Yeah.
That's why so many of us fail. As chefs, I think our education is one of the steepest and most challenging to learn how to cook. Like, that's what chefs learn how to do, and it can take so many of us so long.
And doing then it well.
This is just to learn how to cook, or how to cook. We never really, how long does it take us to learn how to manage? How long does it take us to learn how to create a report? How long does it take us to create a budget? How long does it take to create a business plan, a working business model? How long does it take for us to learn how to teach, man? Yeah. How many of us as chefs suck at teaching? We're the worst teachers out there sometimes because we're impatient and deadlines come quick in the kitchen. I don't have the time to give you the thorough education on how to freaking butcher this pheasant. I can't think how to debone the chicken when you're fast enough right now. So either I'm going to do it agitated, or I'm going to pull it from you, do it myself, and give you something else to do. And you feel like shit now. Yeah. You feel inadequate. You feel useless. And as a chef, I have too much pride to hit you. Man, I shouldn't have done that. I'm sorry. Yo. Like, you know, I was a bit busy. No, I just get some service, and maybe I throw you a beer at the end of the night. Hit you in
the face. Yeah, we have different. That's where you and me got different angles, you see. So,
what? Maybe you're a better teacher. I try to improve on how I teach, and I try to teach well. I do try to teach well. I try to offer a very unconventional experience. Yeah, because I won't. And this is what I'm saying. I don't have to be a good teacher. Someone else can teach you better than me. What I can teach that most chefs don't is the importance of teaching yourself.
I like that. So you want somebody who's coming in as a good student. You want somebody who's coming in who wants to learn, who wants to.
I think that's the best way for both of us to prosper. For me, I need someone who wants to learn, not just someone. I don't need someone who wants to make money or
I don't know.
Someone else teach you how to do that, or someone who I don't know.
Yeah,
I want someone who wants to learn, because I believe that the affinity for learning is what's going to separate most of us in this career. How much? Because you still have to learn continually. And like, look at how much we learned last year, chefs. Chefs became entrepreneurs. Chefs became logistic, like strategists, man. We became problem solvers. So many chefs have never had to problem solve in their lives. Now we had to.
This
is a skill that we'll never lose. Like, when we survive this pandemic and everything, we will be immensely stronger. Immensely. The guys in them, I have 1,000% faith that the chefs that survived the pandemic will survive the next 10 years. The next 10 years. 100%. 100%. 100%. 100%. Don't mean for it to be so grim and everything, but, oh, man.
It's a hard game, mate.
It is a grim
year. Yeah.
It's been a grim year. It's been a grim year.
Oh, brilliant, man.
When are you going to start writing again?
You know what? I've got a few things, like, scribbled down, but, mate, my mojo's gone. So I'll hope to start writing properly again soon, but...
Well, I'm going to take you to write.
One of my posts, which you've got on the staff game, that's usually a couple of days. It's like one day of like, I'll sit there and for 2 hours knock out the blog, and then I'll leave it, and then I'll come back to it and
proofread
it myself, go through it, I'll give it to somebody else, and then, but there's sometimes it's like the amount of blogs that are in the junk file because I've read it the next day, and you look at it and you're thinking, I can't say that. And then you think,
you can't, and this is why can't you? And I know one day in the future, guys, I guarantee one day in the future I'm going to say something that I really shouldn't. I know it's going to happen, and I just hope that when I do say it, no one takes it the wrong way, or at least the people that I care about, I hope they don't take it the wrong way. But people who don't like me aren't going to like what I have to say anyway, you know? Like, people who are predisposed to disagree with anything I have to say, I'd love to tell you something that you're not going to like. That shit excites me, yo. That makes me so excited. It agitates me in a positive way, man. But it is what it is. Brian, this has been a lovely chat with you, bro.
No, you know what? It's been good to finally actually see you face-to-face. We've had messages back and forth for the last...
We actually don't live that far away from each other, man.
I know, but...
When this wraps up, we definitely have to link up. We need to do more together, man. I'd like to do that. And unfortunately, COVID has forced me into that appreciation, into that dimension of appreciation of what we have.
Yeah, well, this is it, man. I've been wanting to come down to your place for long. Every time I see your food and I see the, you know, when seeing the restaurant, and I think it was on my list for last year. Mm-hmm. Last year I wanted to come down, and it was like,
Man, you gotta come. You gotta let me know when you're coming, and we have to make this a worthwhile experience for you, man. And then the next thing we gotta do, we gotta go somewhere and eat together. I want us to go to London and eat, man, and really sit on and have a very casual experience dining.
Well, we've got we've now got a Michelin star in Suffolk, so we've got
Congrats, yo!
Peas porridge, man. They got a Michelin star, so that's up the road. So I'm going straight in there.
Oh man, respect. Anyway, Brian, I gotta go. I gotta get on.
I gotta go as well.
Yo, thank you so much for this time.
No. Thank you. This has been Brian. Been good. A lot of love coming in.
Everything you do, man. Enough respect. Broke dinner.
Yes, mate. Nice. I'll catch you later. Okay.
Okay, thanks for listening to that. That was a real good, in-depth, long chat. they're not always going to be that long, so don't worry. Unless it's content. I mean, there's nothing I could have taken out of that. I just enjoyed it. So I put the whole chat up. Okay, I've got plans for a slightly different format coming next time. So watch this space. Thanks for listening.